This is an interview with Mr. Silas Kraft for the McKeldin Jackson Project of the Maryland Historical Society on July 8th, 1976 at Mr. Kraft's home in Montgomery County, Maryland. The interviewer is Richard Richardson. Mr. Kraft, please tell us something about your early life, education, and involvement with the civil rights movement.
Well, my early life was spent basically in southern West Virginia, around Kimball, West Virginia. Although I was born in Virginia, I moved to West Virginia at age 5 and resided with an uncle and maternal uncle and his wife. And then my mother moved back to West Virginia herself in about 1928, and I remained in West Virginia up until the time I entered the armed services in 1943. My first involvement with the NAACP as a civil rights organization really started around 1924 at about age 6 when I started selling the Christmas seals. And the originator of the Christmas seal for the NAACP was Mrs. Memphis T. Garrison, who herself was a native of West Virginia. And of course, she was quite instrumental in getting around disseminating this material. And many of us as youngsters would sell the stamps at 1 cent a piece back there in 1924 and report the money then to someone, I don't recall whom, possibly my aunt collected the money and turned it over to some of the auxiliaries or some of the ladies who were instrumental conducting the project. Then I stayed rather alert to NAACP activities in the early days of my life, right on up through high school, although there was no youth branch for you to join. There was just no youth branches in that part of southern West Virginia. So most of my relationship then was through reading materials about Walter White, the coming of Walter with Roy Wilkins in 1931 as editor of The Crisis, and many succeeding events involving the NAACP as it worked very diligently towards trying to get the enactment of a federal anti-lynch law. And I had become rather versed in the subject matter by the time I graduated from high school in 1936. But I didn't officially join any NAACP branch until I came to Maryland in 1945. And I worked with the Howard County Group of Citizens in reorganizing the Howard County branch of the NAACP. After that was done, I played a very active part in recruiting members, practically the width of Howard County. Spent a lot of Sunday afternoons, Saturdays, soliciting members, young, old, and what have you. And each year I would average, I guess, around 100 to 120 memberships in Howard County. Then in 1947, we started an active drive to try to get a high school for the black youth in Howard County. And I played a very important part with the NAACP in gathering information, both past and present, about the educational level and the educational lags between the races in Howard County. And I visited churches, wrote memoranda, published a lot of materials, gathered data, disseminated with people, and sought spokesmen to exercise some initiative with the Board of Education in seeking an improved school building or a learning facility. This facility came into being in 1949. I was principal of the school in of the high school in Howard County from 1944 until the time I left, or the end of school year, 1955-56. I left Howard County then as a school person and came to Montgomery County as principal of the Carver High School here at Rockville, Maryland. I remained there as principal until 1960, when the school was closed and the desegregation process here. I left there and went to Montgomery Blair High School as assistant principal. I remained there for 5 years, then went on academic leave, and subsequently went on another leave that carried me to the Middle West to work as an educational consultant to the Mid-Continent Regional Educational Laboratory. Out in that area, I kept my active NAACP membership and remained a member of the National Board, to which I was elected in 1962 or 63, I don't recall the exact year, possibly 63. My work there kept me in contact with a large number of individuals of rather important status in the states of Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. I was the director of 4 pilot schools in the cities of Kansas City, Missouri, Omaha, Nebraska, Wichita, Kansas, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. I learned to know a number of people who were very active in community affairs, who could and did play a very important part in the shaping of educational policies and procedures in our respective communities. My chief interest, however, was from the community school aspect, and I worked more or less with people that I recruited in these various centers as a community coordinator of activities. But my whole goal was to bring together various and sundry groups around a common policy of improving the educational program for all citizens. And working with diverse groups in various communities, and my emphasis was to try to educate them to ways and means of utilizing the school program fully. First, as the parent became well informed, naturally it was a source of interest, of greater interest for the child. But we did bring into those areas a large number of people who had remained and probably would have forever remained aloof of the school. The school program just does not touch large numbers of parents throughout this nation, in spite of it being labeled a public school. From the time I went on the National Board in the early 60s, I guess I've been a part of almost every major plan that the National Association has fostered with respect to education, housing, unemployment, political action, and you name the other various sundry programs. And of course, now I am very much involved in plans of the organization dealing with operational procedures internally to national issues. I first met Mrs. Jackson, who became quite an inspiration to me, in the mid-40s. I was principal of the high school in Howard County. She had had very close and personal relationships with Howard County since one of her parents had resided or was reared in Howard County. I became a secretary of the State Conference of Branches and worked with her 2 or 3 years in that capacity. Most of my work, however, was either on a Friday evening or most of Saturday. And I worked out of the state office in Baltimore City, which is located that particular time on Drude Hill and Dolphin Street. We would do much of our work on Saturdays over the telephone. She would make the contacts, and I would follow up with the contribution coming from organizations, from leading personalities, from state officials, city officials, and her memory was fantastic, and her ability to touch people at all levels was really an amazing fact. She could stay on the phone and do more than an average person could do in years out in the area working. And not only did she infect me with her enthusiasm and her drive and organizing ability, she affected large numbers of people who still remain in the NAACP as we know them today. I could name a number up in Howard County, Reverend John Holland, Mrs. Leola Dorsey, and Prince George's County at that particular time, it was Mrs. Hester King, very instrumental. Mr. Young from St. Mary's Counties, Mr. Stuckey from Charles County, Mrs. Dorothy Black from Queen Anne's County, and I guess I have to take a piece of paper and write down the various names and personnel to get them all together. And of course, she remained and laid on touch younger persons like Attorney Samuel Hamilton, who is right here in Montgomery County. Now, at that particular time, he's very active in Frederick County. But in getting back to Mrs. Jackson, the interesting part about her was an untiring effort to go anywhere that was a problem affecting the civil rights of a minority member. She did not care what time of night or how far the problem was removed from Baltimore City. As president of the State Conference of Branches, she felt that she had a right and a responsibility. She kept with her a cadre of young lawyers at that time that were coming to, and the person of Judge Robert Watts, who is now on the bench, Judge Harry Cole in Baltimore City, Judge Hargrave, her own daughter, Tony Juanita Mitchell, has just a few of them. And prior to that, she had a Tony Murray, who was the first to come out of the law school at the University of Maryland. Matter of fact, he was used as a plaintiff in the case to break the barrier to blacks entering the law school at the University of Maryland. He was an early participant in the field of civil rights. And of course, the person who was called upon to take the yeoman's task in cases affecting school matters, affecting police brutality, and what have you, was a Tony Tucker Daring. And he stayed with the organization very close and went from county to county and did a considerable amount of work on a purely charitable basis, because he has been followed by others since that. But probably some of our best legal groundwork in Maryland was done during the years between 1949 to 63. And much of this was during her administration, following closely on the heels of her daughter's administration, State Conference President. I was also introduced in the early years to the work of the national organization by Mrs. Jackson. She didn't have money to pay the total cost of one traveling to those conventions, but she was always able somehow or another in early days to include you in a delegation to go with some amount appropriated to supplement your expenses. Of course, the rest of your expenses certainly had to come from your pocket or from some sponsoring organization. In my case, it always came from your pocket. In the years of 1963, I suppose, I took office as president of the Howard County branch of the NAACP. Our major drive, of course, at that particular time was on fully desegregating the schools in Howard County, seeking a black policeman in the county. Up until that time, there wasn't a single black person on the police force in Howard County. Now, I don't know what else you want me to say. I can't call any major cases at this particular time that I would like to recall without notes. So I'd rather find some of my historical data before I attempt to pinpoint cases, places, and time. We had some ugly cases in those days. We certainly had the case. I guess you better cut that off, but I got to reflect a minute.
Mr. Kraft, what was it like being a black man in the United States Army in the 40s?
Well, at the time I went in the Army in 1942, I took the examination, qualifying examination, since I was interested in going into the Air Corps. I was accepted and placed on Lee status, November 30th, 1942, and I stayed in that category until March 1943, and I was called overnight for active duty. From that point on, the experience was rather humiliating. The way you were addressed, you colored fellows. From Fort Hays, Columbus, Ohio, to Keesler Field, Biloxi, Mississippi, to Tuskegee Army Air Base, Tuskegee, Alabama. The black soldier was constantly a subject of abuse on the post by his commanding officers, although we were cadets and perhaps to regard it a little higher level of courtesy than some other branches of the service, you still could feel the various and indignities. Of course, when you're on the flying line, you could be rebuked sometime and with the dirtiest kind of epithets. Your color was frequently alluded to by your flight trainers, particularly if you pull a boner executing a certain kind of maneuver, you might be called most anything. It took a great deal of endurance on the part of the cadet. Some took it in a rather reserved manner. Some became emotionally disturbed by the process. Now, we were told that much of this process was conditioning you for combat. Once you are up there in a dogfight or something, either your life or the other fellow's life, your ability to carry out the mission or to fail in the attainment of that mission. Another thing that was very resentful to us was the mere fact that we were not always given the best equipment. We were given the low altitude P-40 fighters to train in, that is, after you had passed your upper basic and moved on up into the higher levels of flight training. I had done an unfortunate experience of not finishing the flight course. I received either injury or some others while doing a physical training on the course. Spent a very lengthy period in the hospital, something exceeding 6 months, and much of that I was confined to the bed, not able to do anything with my lower extremities. But I could do one thing, and did do a lot of studying, reading, some incidental writing during that period of time. So it wasn't just a case of just laying in the hospital, but a case of utilizing my mental faculties, since I couldn't do the thing I had enlisted in service to do, which was learn to fly, graduate a pilot, which was looked upon as an element of pride by those of us who were in the Air Corps. We wanted to be. Most of us had chosen to go there. The only way a black was accepted at that time was as a volunteer. I was there during the time that Judge Hasty made a plea in behalf of not only the black cadets and all soldiers. And you will recall that he resigned as aide to the Secretary of War with these famous words, $10,000 won't buy me. And much of his ongoing discussion had been trying to obtain better conditions, better treatment for the American black soldiers.
What was your reaction to the Supreme Court's 1954 decision, Brown versus the Board of Education?
Oh, I heard all the coming of it. I thought it was long overdue. I never endorsed the dual school program, far back as I could remember, which probably would be about my third or fourth grade in school. I never thought it made sense. In the area where I grew up, people were coal miners. A few minutes after a person entered the mine, you couldn't tell just by looking at whether they're black or white. Of course, there were speech patterns, other characteristics that would distinguish. Then we lived all next door, front yard, backyard, above you, adjacent to you. All nationalities. It was really a mixture of cultures where I grew up. We did most everything else together. We made our own swimming pools. We swam together, we played games together, we fought each other, we fought for each other. We ate out of each other's homes, across the fence, the backyard. We shared whatever we had with each other when we were together. But when we got ready to go to school, we divided. And to us, even as youngsters growing up, it never made sense to many of us. So I've always been an opponent of the dual school system. And I never have been able to believe that separate but equal doctrine was ever applicable to the program. So I've been an avowed opponent, I'd say, the major portion of my life to any so-called policy of separation. And I viewed it very much as I view the apartheid policy in Africa today.
Why did it take so long, and in some instances it's still hasn't been accomplished? In Howard County, for example, why were you still fighting for integration or desegregation of schools almost 10 years after the fact?
Well, it was attitude of the majority. They had long-standing traditional barriers, and they were firm believers in it. They could respect a black person, but they had little but disdain for a black group, whether they be children or adults. The general belief was, and still is, that there has to be somebody that I am superior to, or someone who is inferior to me. And our program, our school program today, has not been integrated. We've had the semblance of desegregation, and in many instances resegregation, as a white flight has occurred. So that unwillingness to break away from traditional attitudes certainly was very typical at that particular time in Howard County. Howard County was much smaller then. The new city of Columbia was had not come into being in 1954, and didn't come into being until, well, it started in 66, really building and making its advent. I think the first house was sold perhaps in the last couple of months of 1966. So you had deep-seated reservations in Howard County, and it's like you had and still have deep-seated reservations in Montgomery County.
Do you think there's any difference between the more urban areas, such as Baltimore and Washington, and the counties, such as Howard County, Montgomery County? Do you think there's less resistance to desegregation in an urban area?
No, I would equate the resistance now, perfectly. In the very beginning, Montgomery County was the forerunner, had a strong desire to set an example for the nation. But the attitude in Montgomery County has definitely changed now. It's become one of deceit, and many subtleties are involved in it. The deep-seated feelings are shown in various and sundry ways in Montgomery County. I don't know as much about the attitude in Howard County, since I'm not as close to the subject matter anymore. I wouldn't comment about it.
How about back in the 50s, though, when you were in Howard County? How was the feeling, and the feeling you got from, like, for example, working with Mrs. Jackson in the city, and maybe the city environment or the urban environment was more...
Howard County was more cautious, but I would say it was more receptive than the inner city situation was. And there was very strong resistance in certain aspects of Baltimore City, South Baltimore, for instance. And then you got out more in the, shall we say, the higher middle class areas of Baltimore City. Very little. Because the inner city problem were early attacked and somewhat resolved with respect to desegregation. The Baltimore City built up to the plight that it's in now due to certain evasive and deceptive means used by those who make the policies and those who implement it. In Howard County, being a kind of an open rural area, when they did start desegregating, it didn't create the problem of concentrated groups the way it did in the city. Of course, since that time, Howard County has grown with the coming of Columbia. They have some other problems, but not so much, as I understand, as they relate to desegregation school. I think the problem are now related to the ongoing activities within the walls of the school. There, I understand, is considerable friction at times in some of the schools as the students are assembled within the walls of the school. I don't know as much about it since I don't care to comment about it.
Mr. Kraft, during your civil rights involvement in the late 40s and the 50s, were you ever threatened or was there ever pressure put on you from any groups or individuals?
No, I could not truthfully say I was ever threatened, or no one ever applied any undue pressure on me. I can only tell her what happened. I was demoted as a high school principal in this county in 1960. And stayed in a demoted state as assistant principal until 1971. So I went through 11 years of a demoted status in this county.
As a result of what?
Well, as a result of the so-called program of desegregation. I just was not considered for a principalship, and I rather suspect and have been told by others that it was my attitude towards civil rights and in some instances my outspoken and shall I say a zeal for what I felt and still feel was the right thing. I felt that a program of desegregation meant total involvement, both people and staff. I still do in the process. I do not believe that you can desegregate anything and not totally involve the parties therein. So I felt when the program of desegregation started with a first decapitation of the school, they either changed the school, closed the school, or demoted the principal of the school, that was not truly desegregation. The same old prejudicial manners that I have observed all my life. So in spite of my experience, in spite of my record as a professional educator, it came time to make apply that principle. It was always something different with me.